Welcome to this, the second episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Special Agent Darren Mott. And in this episode, I'll talk to fellow retired FBI Special Agent Scott Agabaum on how he got involved in cyber investigations with the FBI way back in the Stone Age of the 1990s. And we'll talk about his best-selling book, The Secret to Cybersecurity. First off, I want to thank everyone who downloaded and listened to episode one of the podcast. It's now available on iTunes if you choose to go look there and download it to your favorite podcast application. Feel free to tell your friends and coworkers and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you are so inclined, you can leave reviews on my website as well, thecyberguy.com, cyber spelled C-Y-B-U-R. I'm going to try to get this distributed on Spotify and Google's podcasts. Platforms as well, but that's going to take a couple episodes to get that squared away through my podcast distributor, so you can look for them there. Regardless of that, again, I thank you for listening. I know it's a new venture for me and a new podcast for you to listen to, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen to them. I hope to provide information that's useful, not, again, like I mentioned in the first episode, not just for yourself, but also for your business, because cybersecurity is everybody's problem at this point. It's not just problem for people with millions and billions of dollars and multi-billion dollar companies. The smallest companies in the world, as long as they have a web presence or some kind of computer network, are just as vulnerable to cyber attacks as pretty much anyone else. Before we get to Scott, let's start with a couple news or cybersecurity items I want to mention just because a couple of these things happened this week and I thought they were useful to talk about. The first one is clickbait scams. You'll see a lot of these online. If you go to websites, you'll see a lot of interesting news articles that are designed to make you click on them to go read them. It brings traffic to those sites. And cyber criminals have realized that this is a effective way to try to target folks to go to their websites, click on links within their websites. An example this week, a friend of mine called me and asked me to talk to his mother. She had clicked on a link and they were afraid that her computer had been compromised. She may have lost some personal identifiable information and things like that. So I went and listened to it, went and called her and talked to her. And what had happened was she was on Facebook and she had seen a news article about Betty White. So she decided to click on that. And as soon as she did, a webpage popped up saying her computer had been compromised and to call this number to get it fixed. So she called that number, talked to a gentleman with a British accent, and he wanted her to, in order to get her computer unlocked, go to a local grocery store. Ideally, what would probably happen was he'd ask her to get some gift cards and to send him the information on that gift card. Well, fortunately, she recognized it to be a scam pretty easily, turned off her computer, hung up with the guy, and didn't give him any information about herself or anything like that. So as I was talking to her, I had her bring back up her computer. She was able to boot it back up, get to her web browser, and there was really nothing bad there. So, well, I got her to delete the web page and delete her history and some other things. But effectively, it was a clickbait scam. It wasn't so much ransomware. It actually wasn't ransomware. What happened was by clicking on it, it puts up a web page that makes it look like that you've been compromised. And as a result, you call the number. You try to figure out how to get your computer unlocked when indeed it is not even locked up. If you can go to another application with this web page up, it is simply a scam. It is nothing more. It is not, in most cases, not going to say all, but in most cases, not collecting any data off your computer. And unless you call the number and give them your information, they really don't have access to it. The worst of these I see is where it says that your computer's infected, call this number for Apple support or for Windows support to get it fixed. And then they ask for access to your computer. People give them access to the computer, and then they can install malware. They can look around. They can, you know, steal passwords if you have those stored on a notepad or something of that nature. So, again, if you can get to other applications or other things on your computer, you are not locked up with ransomware. If you can't get to anything, then indeed you do have ransomware. And in that case, what you would need to do is to basically reformat your computer. So ideally, when you buy a computer, make sure you keep your if they send you, they don't do this anymore, but they used to send CDs with stuff to reformat the computer. Now it's a drive usually on the computer. It's a recovery drive, and you can Google search how to, for your particular computer, reset your computer back to factory settings. Again, there's a drive on there that's isolated that should allow you to do that should you have that problem. And in most cases, the guys doing the real ransomware, the actual locking up of networks and computers, are going to ask for Bitcoin payment, not gift card payment. So if you're getting requests to go get to get gift cards, that is a scam of some sort. There's an IRS scam that goes around where you get a phone call saying that the IRS has blocked your Social Security number. When you call them, they ask you to stay on the line. They make you go down to Walmart, buy gift cards, and send it to them. That's a scam. They don't have any information on you. You can pretty much hang up on those guys and ignore them all you like. They're not going to come and arrest you or anything like that. So that is the basis for these, how these clickbait scams work. The big ones now are largely COVID clickbait. You're seeing a lot of that. And that's going to result not just in websites that they use for this clickbait, but also in clicks within emails and phishing emails that they'll send to you. So they're going to use phishing emails that look like they're coming from your health officials, like doctors or national agencies like the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, your state health department, especially if you've had a COVID test. And then you would think that, okay, this email makes sense. They're sending me some information about my COVID test. I probably need to look at it. And they want you to click information to view about new coronavirus cases around your city, what to do since you've tested positive, or what to do since you've tested negative, because they're really spamming this out to whoever will get it based on email lists they find on the dark web. And basically, if you've had an email address in the last 10 years, your email is somewhere easily identifiable and in some kind of list that they can send out bulk emails to try to get folks to click on links or go to websites that are in those particular emails. So once you're, if you're prompted to download an attached PDF to, quote, learn about safety measures you can take against spreading the virus, do not open that PDF. If you don't expect to get an email, then do not keep it. If you get something that looks like it's from your state health department, go to the state health department webpage and see what they have there. Do not trust emails coming from individuals that look legitimate, especially when it comes to COVID-19. There's a lot of, it's probably the number one scam tactic being used now is using COVID as a way for people to access things and click on stuff they're not supposed to click on. So, and if you click on a phishing link, you may be brought to a web page designed to steal your personal information. If you download a PDF file or a Word document or a PowerPoint document, that could potentially infect your computer. And if that's the case, then you're going to need to, like I said, if you have an infection or you have something bad like that happens, you're going to need to reformat your machine back to factory settings to ensure that it's pretty much clear of any malware on your device. So that is the news and cybersecurity items of the week. Now let's go and talk to my good friend, retired FBI Special Agent Scott Angenbaum. He retired from the Nashville Division in 2018 after 29 years working for the FBI. So Scott, welcome to the Cyber Guy podcast. I appreciate you being guest number one for this. Well, I assume will be a recurring role as a frequent contributor to the podcast, as you're the one guy I know who's actually said, yeah, heck, I'll be on your podcast. Everybody else is like, I got to check with somebody and make sure that's okay. So for those who don't know, well, for everybody who doesn't know, I met Scott in 2004. He became a program manager for me as an FBI headquarters supervisor, and he gave me a lot of money. And as a result, he got promoted to go to the Nashville field office, and I took a similar job at FBI headquarters, and I started sending him a lot of money. I believe every large screen TV in the Nashville RA is probably attributed to me in some way, shape, or form. Would you say that's more or less true?
Absolutely. It was kind of a fun game of give and take, let's just say.
Right. And I like to say I was the original
between two friends.
I was the original botnet for the Angenbaum botnet, which became a system of FBI agents and private sector folks who Scott co-opted into doing his bidding, if you will. So I like to think of myself as one of the original botnets. Now, fortunately, I took that skill and created my own botnet as I went through my career. But I'm not sure. I'm assuming my case is different than yours. But my botnet has started to decrease as I've no longer been in the Bureau. I assume yours has only increased.
Oh, tremendously. When you have SACs coming to me all the time asking to help them get a job. And I always like to say, what kind of skills do you have again? So pretty funny.
So tell us how you became an FBI agent. I know you retired with 29 years in the Bureau, but those 29 weren't always as an agent. So how did you get to, how did you achieve your 29 years in the FBI?
My career path was a little different than most people that I've met. I grew up in New York City, raised by a single parent. Things were a little different than the way I raised my kids. My mom was just happy when I went from seventh grade to eighth grade. That was a victory in the Augenbaum household. When I graduated high school, she was so excited I was going to community college. I graduated high school with a 72 average. I said I was going to get my act together in community college. And when I graduated community college with a 2.27 grade point average, I think that was probably lower than the 72 average. And my mother, in her best New York accent, said, "Oi, we finally have a college graduate in the family." She was so proud of me. But when you have a 2.27 grade point average, the world is not knocking down your doors with opportunity. But the federal government will always hire you as a GS-3 file clerk making $12,038 a year. And I show up at the FBI headquarters September 6, 1988, all excited to get a gun and a badge. And they said, "Slow down, Sparky, you're only a file clerk." And my mother has said to me numerous occasions that was part of her grand plan to keep me out of jail. And what a great plan, because here I was, here it was 1988. I'm embedded into the FBI as a support employee. I'm surrounded by a lot of positive role models who mentor me, explain to me that you can't really be a success in life with being somewhere between below average and mediocre. And I got my act together. I went back to college at night. I received a bachelor's degree from City College with a 3.7 grade point average. I have to brag about that, because when you have a 2.27, you have to validate it. Started working on an MBA in finance and technology at Fordham University in 1992. I was a wizard in technology, especially for the federal government, because I knew how to use Microsoft Excel. And I actually got a QSI, which is a bonus, because I get this, Darren, don't faint. I took a row of numbers and I added them and I actually put them into a memo. And I a bonus for that.
Yeah, but the early 1990s, that was big cyber movement in the FBI.
Absolutely. And here I am, just working, and I finally have a career goal. I mean, I really do not want to carry a gun. I don't want to be a law enforcement officer. I am making deals. I'm doing what I always did in my whole entire life. I started at a young age. I wanted to go down to the world. I wanted to go down to Wall Street. I wanted to go into the world of investment banking. Started taking technology classes at Fordham University in 1992. It was amazing. I would have to take the train an hour and a half to go to New York City just so I could use the Bloomberg terminal and LexisNexis, which was the coolest thing in the world. I didn't have to actually get books. I just, you still had to travel an hour and a half. And I remember my graduate classes, they were talking about one day we would be able to actually purchase airline tickets through a computer. I mean, really? I mean, that was innovation at its finest, and opportunity opened up to become an FBI agent. Thanks, November of 1994, and there was a hiring freeze in the FBI from 91 to 94. They didn't hire any FBI agents, and all of a sudden, boom, we had to hire agents. And my boss came to me, and he said, "Hey, got great news. The agent position's opening up. You need to put in for it." And I looked at him, and I said, Bob Grubert was my supervisor. I said, "Bob, not what I want to do. I don't want to be an FBI agent. I want to work on Wall Street. I want to make deals." And he said to me, and he was kind of like one of the true father figures that I had in my life. And he sat me down and he said, "Scott, you need to put in for this." He goes, "With your attitude, you probably will not get it, but you need to try." And I didn't want to disappoint him. So that's kind of how the story appear, you know, came together that I, and here I am the week before Thanksgiving driving down to Quantico, Virginia, and I pull off probably a couple of exits at the rest stop before, and I went like this. What the heck did I just do to my life? Because like you, this is something you really wanted to do. So I get down there to Quantico, Virginia, and now it's the first time, you know, I don't know if you, were you married when you were into the academy?
Married, two kids.
Okay. I'm 26 years old. I'm still living in the same house I grew up with. And, you know, I packed a bag and, you know, it was like going to graduate school. And I got down there and I was like, what am I doing here? I go, these people, they're not like me. And I grunted it out and I'm all excited there. And I want to go back to New York City. I want to go back to New York City to be an FBI agent. And I figure now I'm really into it and so excited. If I can't work on Wall Street, I'll put them all in jail. I put my MBA on hold. I just, you know, have my room. I'm ready to go back. I'll probably be the only FBI agent in the New York office living at home with his mom. And I'm sure that there's probably a lot of those guys. And then all of a sudden, you go up. Do you remember the day when you went up and you got your orders? What was your number one choice? What did you pick?
Pittsburgh.
And you got Charlotte as your number one choice, right?
Charlotte was number 12, but that's what I got, Charlotte. Yeah, so, yep.
So New York is short on FBI agents. We're down 170 agents. So I go, I'm going to play the game. I'm going to put Boston down as my first choice, New York second. Newark, New Jersey, third, like New Haven, fourth, all these areas around it. And I get my orders and they ask you, do you remember, where do you think you're going? Where do you want to go? Where do you think you're going? And I get up and I open it up and I go, I'm put Boston down as my first choice. I think I'm going to New York. And I pick it up and it says Syracuse, New York. And I just stopped. It was the first time I was probably ever silent for more than 3 seconds. I look at the class and I have that little, it's week 8. And that voice is going on in my head. And it's saying, Scott, do not cry in front of the class. You will never recover.
And I should make a point that, so Scott being from New York, so Scott and I are both New Yorkers. Different kind of New Yorkers. Scott's from New York City. I'm from the opposite end of the state, north of Syracuse. So I know exactly what he's going into. And I cannot imagine that the fear in your head as you're thinking, F in Syracuse, what the hell is there to do? What kind of crime is there in Syracuse?
Exactly. So I get up there and I'm driving on the side. I'm driving up. I stop in Binghamton. I get on the payphone. I call my mom. I go, Mom, you'll never believe this. I'm seeing cows on these farms on the side of the road. I remember this. I didn't, you know, you saw them in books. And as I get up there, I just go, I'm going to do 2 years in upstate New York, and then I'm going to go back to New York City. Because this is upstate. What am I going to do? Stolen cow cases? Stolen snowmobile cases? So I get up, and Syracuse is out of the
office. Neither of one is a federal crime, I should know.
Yes. And so is cow tipping, too, I think, on federal land, that is.
That's true.
But I get up there, and I'm a little intimidated, Darren, because Syracuse was a very, very small city. I mean, Syracuse had 175,000 people in the city and 500,000 in the county. That was the size of my housing projects that I lived in growing up as a kid. So I get up there and I absolutely fall in love with it and have the greatest time there. Because if you would ask me to describe the role of an FBI agent in 1995, I would say it was so easy to explain. Bad people did bad things to good people in those 5 counties that I covered, which was Onondaga, Cayuga, Oswego, Jefferson. And what was the one where
Syracuse,
you were from?
Syracuse.
St. Lawrence.
Or St. Lawrence. St. Lawrence. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. 5 counties. And what did I do? I worked with state and local cops, and we put bad guys in jail. What a fun and exciting job for a 26-year-old kid from Brooklyn, New York, a gun, a badge, a bulletproof vest. And this was working in a resident agency, not a field office. So whatever came through the door, you were running and gunning. And every day was a new day. It was a bank robbery, a fugitive, a drug case. And here I am getting called and running purely off of adrenaline, because you'd be in the office. You'd be the only guy in the office, and it would go like this. Hey, bank robber, you need to go out there. Go out there and do what? You know, it was so much fun. Let's get the record straight. I did not join the FBI to work cyber crime or intellectual property rights cases. That was not what I wanted to do.
Well, I would argue in 1995, the FBI wasn't working those anyway. They weren't even sure what the cyber threat was or how to deal with it or who would handle it.
Well, exactly. But I got sucked into cybercrime in 1996 because I got a telephone call from a small internet service provider in Fulton, New York. And he calls me up. And that was the great thing about being an agent. Somebody calls you up. You want to get out of the office. You jump in your car. You talk to them. So I go to this small internet service provider. You remember the days when they were ISPs, little mom and pop shops all over the place. And the guy wants to talk about selling stolen property on these things called bulletin boards. Now, since I was highly skilled in America Online navigation, I knew a little bit about what the bulletin boards were. And I was the only guy in the office who knew anything about that. So I went out there and I talked to this guy. And I walk into his office and there are monitors that have color, and there are video images, and there are people talking back and forth, and there are all these crazy images going around. I don't even remember what the heck this thing, this hit the call was about. I just remember that prompted me to go out and buy my first computer. But I wasn't one of these computer geeks or anything like that. But Windows 95 came along and made things easy. Do you remember the days of DOS, Darren?
Sure. My first computer was a Packard Bell in 1993. And Prodigy and CompuServe were the two internet options. AOL was always there, but I had Prodigy. I had Prodigy. I didn't have CompuServe. And Prodigy had the bulletin boards and all that kind of stuff. And there was, I remember the old, would you put a dollar in an envelope, send it to five people, and then put your name and they'll send it to five people? The chain letter, right. So the chain letter was being propagated through these message boards. I remember that distinctly in 1993 or so.
Well, when I go out and I do my talks, and I get out all the time, I ask people, I go like this, hey, does anyone remember the days of DOS? And a couple of people raise their hands. And then I say, hey, can anyone tell me anything fun and productive you did with DOS? And before people raise their hands, I go, whoa, don't raise your hand. It meant you didn't date very much in high school or college because DOS was hard. Windows 95 came along, boom, plug and play. So here I go. I go to Gateway. Remember Gateway stores? Sure, yeah. That's how you know you're old, if you remember Gateway. Bought the best piece of technology I could for $2,500. I bought a blazing fast 133 megahertz processor, which is probably in any, nothing has 133 megahertz. I got a 40 megabyte hard drive and a flat screen monitor, which was probably 19 inches that weighed about 75 pounds. And I bring my computer home, and this is how you know you're old. When you go, you bring your computer home and you forgot to buy one thing to make it work. Can you take a guess? Well, what did you have to buy?
Floppy disks. Didn't have the floppy disks. Not the floppy disks.
No, a browser. The browser didn't come. Computers didn't come with a browser. That's how you know you're old. You had to go out. And you remember, what was the browser of choice in 96?
Netscape.
Absolutely, the Netscape browser. And here I am. I'm off to the races. One thing that was interesting. So, but by default, I become the cyber guy in the office, which is not the fun and sexy job to have. I mean, And I remember being, I go to my supervisor at the time, and I say to him, hey, I want to take this class, Introduction to the Internet, which was at Oswego College, and it was $50. So me being me, I just said, hey, I'm going to try to see if I can get the government to pay for this. And my boss came to me at the time and said, no. He goes, why would the FBI ever be interested in this thing called the Internet? Denied. Well, okay. You know, that's kind of, I honestly was scamming over here. But my boss rose through the ranks of the FBI, became eventually the executive assistant director of the FBI. And I remember seeing him back at headquarters. Now in 2003, the FBI forms a cyber division, which I went to work for. And I said, hey, Mike, you getting any better at predicting future crime problems? Because, you know, that didn't work out really well. And then he retired from the FBI at 52 and became the chief security officer of a small ISP called Verizon. And I remember one of the conferences you set me down to that you paid for me when I got sick in 2011, the Fordham conference.
Oh, yeah. 2009.
Wow, 2009. I remember going over and making that comment. And because I said, you know, he went to work as a chief security officer of a small ISP. You may have heard of it. Called Verizon. Two guys start cracking up in the class. I go over, I go, hey, let me guess, you worked with Mike. He goes, yeah. So I wrote on the back of my my business card, I said, you should have paid the $50 because I've gotten more mileage. What a great guy. He's done so much in his life. And he sends me this email. He goes, no matter what I ever accomplish in life, you're always going to be there telling that story. I go, absolutely. He goes, you were a visionary. And I go, I was not a visionary. I was just completely lucky because I fell into it. And, you know, 2003 to 2006, I'm at FBI headquarters. All my friends make fun of me. They all make fun of me because I go to cyber. Because what happens in 2001, September 11th happens, 9/11, terrorism, the number one priority, counterintelligence, number two, cyber, number three. I go down. Everyone says I'm committing career suicide. I remember one agent whose name I will not mention, but I hope to get Rob Haley on the show pretty soon for you. And he says to me, he goes, you know, this cyber crime problem is going to go away in a couple of years because we were just really chasing thrill seekers and amateurs. And I doubled down and I went out. I did a lot of public speaking. I went to Nashville in 2007 as the first supervisor of the FBI's cyber squad. Spent 7 years as a supervisor, did the greatest thing ever. I got out of the management program. I stepped down. During your talks, you're going to explain why people were stepping down. And I spent the last 4 years of my career being the outreach guy. Because one of the big frustrations I had, Darren, working cyber, when I was working regular cases, I felt like a hero. It was so easy. Because here was the model. Somebody would call up. They were victimized. You would identify them. You would interview them, you'd open a case, you'd go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, they would open a corresponding case, you would do your investigation, you would subpoena bank records, you would interview other witnesses, you would build cases up. And sometimes it was quick, but sometimes it took 3 to 4 years to build a case. And when you worked a case, it was you versus the bad guy, and you took the time, and it got to a point where you indicted this subject in front of a grand jury. And by the time after you indicted him, you arrested him, he either pled guilty or went to trial.
Yeah, I should know. You said regular cases. And what you're talking about is non-cyber case. Any case that's not a cyber case, because cyber cases follow non-cyber, a completely different scheme.
Talking traditionally violent crime and white-collar crime cases, which I worked the majority. And I would say in 10 years, I probably brought about 40 cases to conclusion. Some weren't big cases. It was upstate New York. I mean, I had some really small cases, but I had some multi-million-dollar white collar cases, and you felt good. You made a difference because things were going through the system. That was the return on investment. That is how you were judged as a criminal investigator working for the FBI. How many people were you able to prosecute? And you really just had it. We did things called 515s. We took stats. What a great feeling. So when I go into the world of the cyber, I say, I'm going to use that same model, same chain of logic. I'm going to identify subjects, going to get records, going to arrest people, interview witnesses. And as we're going to learn from the way you talk, why cyber cases is much different. We very rarely could find the attribution. We couldn't prove who it was. We didn't have prosecutors that understood the technology. We had privacy laws that really didn't work for us. So we couldn't go out and call Google up and say, hey, give us the records. So that is where I developed an amazing level of frustration during my time in cyber because, you know, when you asked me to come on the podcast, what did you want me to talk about?
Any cases, but I knew that those would be weak.
Well, no. What kind of cases? And like, yeah. I can talk about cases all day, but my cases all fit the same profile.
Sure.
And it really went to the point where, and this is what I talked about. This is where I had this aha moment of being an FBI agent because it was almost like Groundhog's Day. During my career in Nashville, which was 11, 12 years, I had to touch at least 1,000 victims, and they all had the same corresponding elements. When the bad guys stole your stuff, and answer these questions, when the bad guys would steal stuff, money, intellectual property, brands, ransomware, you name it, elderly people's life savings, or they would hurt our most precious commodity, our kids. Can the FBI get your stuff back?
No. Most likely they can. Most likely they will not.
I like to brag and say I am an MVP in the business email compromise. Because I've recovered 4 wire transfers from going overseas. Truth be told, every single one was pure luck. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm an MVP or a Hall of Famer. But the truth be told, if you wouldn't want to get my record, I probably would be going to the Hall of Fame with 4 wins, 17,000 losses.
Well, I like to say I got the Russians to give restitution to 2 major companies in the United States, and that'll be a podcast for a different time. But I did have some success there, limited as it may have been.
Well, you're doing a lot better than I am because I didn't have that kind of success. When the bad guy and the chances of bringing the bad guys to justice were very, very challenging because the bad guys were located overseas in a majority of the cases. They were located over in China, Russia, all these different threat countries, and even countries like Canada, which was very difficult to extradite people. So what did I learn in dealing with almost 1,000 victimizations? Bad guys steal your stuff. You're not getting your money back. And the chances of the FBI putting the bad guys in jail are really, really challenging. Darren, that played with my head. That really impacted me because remember, 10 years I'm running and gunning in Syracuse, working compared to other agents, probably small cases. But I'm doing what I know how to do, and that is working my ass off to put bad guys in jail. Now I become to cyber, and all of a sudden it's like every day it's like, sorry, can't help you. But then I kind of had that aha moment, and I realized that almost 90% of what I dealt with could have been prevented if the victims just really followed a couple of simple elements. So that's what I did. So when I retired, you know, I kind of turned my back on corporate America. I didn't take a job. I just decided that I'm going to follow what I'm passionate about. And what am I passionate about? I'm passionate about taking what I've learned in the FBI and sharing it with the world to help keep people safe. So if you ask me, what do I do for a living? It's very simple. I teach individuals and organizations how not to become the next cybercrime victim without spending money. Am I saying that we don't spend money? Absolutely not. All I'm telling people is if you don't do what I tell you to do for free, which I wrote about in my book, and I go around and I speak all around the country. I used to speak around the world on this. Now I'm doing virtual stuff. If you don't do what I tell you to do for free, I don't care how much money you spend, you are still going to become a victim.
And I should note, in Scott's book is The Secret to Cybersecurity, and there are how many chapters, and you cover pretty much every potential cyber issue that could happen to any person or any business. How many different, like 9 or 10 different chapters of stuff? Yeah, something along those lines. But the key thing, if you are a technical person who does ones and zeros and programs, computers, this is not probably the book for you. But for the 98.7% of the rest of us who are more just, we have computers, we deal with them all the time, this is the book you need to read, because it will kind of lay out, you're not going to find love online. You got to protect your kids. You got to be careful what you click on. And a lot of this, the book is designed around education. And I think that's it.
So if you're right, going to read a book by an FBI agent who put a lot of bad guys in jail, don't read my book. If you're looking for a book by an FBI agent who saved the day, I'm not your guy. So, hey, am I doing a good job selling the book? I wrote a book because I've dealt with so many victimizations, and it was never the appropriate time to put my arm around someone who just lost their life savings and be able to say, this did not have to happen. So that's why I wrote the book, really as nothing more than a passion project, because I would do so many talks when I was an FBI agent, and people would say, hey, where can I get, I'm writing all this down. What do I do? And I would like refer to them to like 17 handouts. So I took all these stories, because it's what I do. I tell stories, and my book is really nothing more than to change behavior. And one of the things that happened about my book organically, and I didn't try to do it, it kind of became like an owner's manual for organizations on how to train their employees. Because I'm going to tell you, in today's day and age, cybersecurity training is failing miserably. Why is that? Think about the times when we would do our training we would buy training off the shelves, where somebody would take a white paper and they would take bad animation and they would go, you got a link, don't click on it. I think, who holds the record, me or you, for getting through our InfoSec training in world record time?
I think I did a 1 year in three minutes, 42 seconds, I think.
Yeah. So, but what one of the things that I found out is things about training, they're not telling stories. They're not making you feel what it's like to become a victim. And that's really what I've done. And my book is not really, and I feel it was my obligation to share these stories with people, because, Darren, it broke my heart. Every day when I dealt with a lot of large breaches, I didn't lose any sleep over it. Because I would sit here and have to deal with the mom and pops. I'd have to deal with this elderly gentleman who was looking online, could have been any of our dads, who looks online, tries to find a certificate of deposit. And he goes online, he searches CDs, interest rates, and he finds this one bank out in California that's offering a certificate of deposit with maybe a quarter of a point higher than the traditional bank. $750,000 for a retiree. That's some cash. So he does some research. He pulls up the bank. He looks online. He does the street view. He contacts the bank. He talks to them over the phone. Everything looks really good. He eventually has his bank wire transfer the $750,000 to this bank. And all of a sudden he does that. Doesn't hear from them again. And he tries to contact them. He can't do it. He contacts his bank, and all of a sudden his bank says, well, where'd you say the bank was? And he says, California. He goes, well, the money was wire transferred to Georgia. The country of Georgia. And from there, by the time we were able to do it, and just think about how much time is needed to get, because we just can't pick up the phone and get records from a bank in Georgia. the country of Georgia. That's whole mutual legal assistance treaties. What's a record amount of time to be able to get information back from the country of Georgia through legal process? How long would it take us to find out who opened that account?
Depending on the attorney writing it for you, if you're lucky, 6 to 7 months, maybe.
6 to 7 months. And you know what they're going to tell you? 6 to 7 months, if you're lucky, they're going to tell me that that money that went to the bank in Georgia was wire transferred to an account in Nigeria. And then how long is it going to take us to get another mutual legal assistance treaty?
Yeah, that one might take more like
and a year. From there.
Yeah, a year for Nigeria, a year if you ever get it. And then they're going to find out it went to Russia, and it doesn't really matter because they won't have held the records long enough, so you're long gone.
And here I am. I'm sitting down with this elderly gentleman who has his full faith in the FBI, wanting to know how come we can't do anything about it. And that's why, you know, I try to make people understand the truth to this, to make them realize that, okay, you got to check this out. Because there's one thing I don't really talk about in my book, computers. I am talking more about the social engineering. And just to go through a couple of things when I'm out there talking, what are we really focusing on? Maybe 8 or 9 points. And what are these points? Email is the number one attack vector. We need to think before we click. That's simple. You're going to get an email from somebody you're not going to get an email from Boris Badenoff. You're going to get an email from somebody you know and trust. You are going to get an email. You have to think before you act. We have to not use the same usernames and passwords and everything like that. And you know what, Darren? I don't even, and this is what I'm going to tell. For your first 5 people who contact me through LinkedIn, just send me a note and I'm going to send you a signed copy of my book, because I don't even want your listeners to buy my book. I'd rather send them a copy of the book. And you're going to see in everything in the book, you're going to read this book and you're going to go, I know all of that. But my goal is to empower the user. And Darren, me and you have a lot to talk about. I think we can do a Jerry Lewis 36-hour telethon
yeah,
about this. But I don't think
my memory card is long enough for that. But I would like to have you back in the future. I'd like to talk more about this education piece, because I think most of the, if you're an end user, you understand, you need to kind of understand these little things, but there's a larger audience out there that doesn't pay attention to that. And that's the C-suite in the companies that don't look at cybersecurity as a holistic problem across their enterprise. And I think you and I have talked about some things focused in that area. And I think that would be useful just to get some folks who might be executives in companies to start thinking about how they deal with education of their employees.
If I can, and here's what I found out by trial and error. If I can get in front of a C-suite and I can teach them why they need to do certain things at home, then they will take that to work. Because everyone's looking, and we're going to talk, and Darren, I know, is going to cover this. The FBI is not going to arrest our way out of the problem, and you are not going to spend your way. The cybercrime problem is getting worse. It's going, according to Cybersecurity Ventures, it's going from a $3 trillion problem to a $6 trillion problem from 2015 to 2021. That's before COVID hit. Now that COVID's hitting, it's even getting worse. But that number doesn't bother me, Darren. The next number bothers me. We are spending almost more on information. We keep spending more on information security, product services, training, insurance, consulting, and the problem keeps getting worse. What does that mean if we spend more money on controls and the problem gets worse? What does that mean?
Like you said, you're not going to be able to, you can't buy your way out of the problem. I'm sure that's not the answer you're looking for.
It means what we're doing isn't working.
Yeah, there you go.
What we're doing is not working.
All right, well, let's leave it there, and we will come back and revisit this at another point in time. Scott, I appreciate your time. I will put Scott's LinkedIn information with the podcast and on my website, so you can find it there. You can look for him on LinkedIn, Scott Augenbaum, AugenBaum. And again, Scott, I appreciate your time, and hope you stay cool up there in Nashville.
Thank you.
All right, let me close with this. As I was editing this podcast today, a news article came across that I wanted to make folks aware of because it likely impacts folks in the who are listening to this podcast, and that is there's an article at Wired.com with the title, Over a Billion Android Devices Are at Risk of Data Theft. So what has happened is there are Android devices that have a chip called the Snapdragon chip, and there are over 400 exploits that have been discovered, or vulnerabilities rather, 400 vulnerabilities in this particular chip that can allow external folks to download video off your device. It can also install malicious apps with no permissions at all. A lot of bad things can happen with this particular device. The problem is there is no current fix, not to say that. So Snapdragon is created by Qualcomm, the company that made it. And so because of the number of processes on this chip, this is where all the vulnerabilities have been found. So quoting this article, regarding the Qualcomm Compute DSP vulnerability disclosed by Checkpoint, they are working to, we are working to validate the issues and make appropriate mitigations to OEMs, basically meaning they're looking for a way to fix this problem. Currently, that problem is not fixable. However, you can protect yourself if you have an Android device that has a Snapdragon chip by making sure that you download apps only from the Google Play Store. That is not 100% effective, but it is better than nothing. Google doesn't exactly vet their apps quite as well as iPhone or as the as Apple does. So there is still somewhat of a risk by some of the apps that you can download from the Google Play Store. But one thing I wouldn't recommend you do not do if you have an Android with this particular chip is to download apps outside of the Google Play Store. That is going to do nothing but raise the risk to your device overall. And really, at the end of the day, all we can do is assess our risk and try to minimize it as best we can by understanding the threats and the vulnerabilities that impact our devices. So as you go through your day, keep in mind that you should understand your threats, assess your risk, and proceed wisely as you go out your day accessing the internet and all that comes with it. I appreciate everyone for listening and downloading. Please tell your friends. I'll have a link to Scott Augenbaum's LinkedIn address associated with this with this podcast, so you can contact him there to be one of the five to get the free book. And enjoy your week. Stay safe.